Welcome to Friends of the Family. We're just in the midst of a series now. Last week, one of the friends of the family is a great theologian of the 20th century. A friend of the family, believers today, is a pastor who was pastor at a very hard time and a very brave young pastor. And next week, G.K. Chesterton. I wrote what I said about Chesterton. He's the friend and the apologist to those who are hard to please. He is a very clever writer, one of the cleverest writers of the English language, had a great influence on C.S. Lewis. Show a little of that, but have a chance to take you on a journey through his life next week. And then Junior on her great heroes, Luther and Calvin together, and that's going to be a challenge to put those two powerful tigers together. That's going to be wonderful too. So it's going to be just a marvelous series. In fact, one week I'm going to do an evening on Fanny Crosby, America's songwriter, one of my heroes. Michael will make sure we sing some Fanny Crosby songs the Sunday before that and the Sunday after that, because I love Fanny Crosby. So we've got a lot of things planned as we look ahead. In 1961, Eberhard Bethge, who was Bonhoeffer's one of his very closest friends, in fact, most of the letters in the Letters and Papers from Prison were written to Eberhard Bethge. Not a relative, but kind of a sure-tail relative, because he married Bonhoeffer's cousin. And one of the beautiful letters in the Letters and Papers is the wedding sermon from a prison cell written to young Eberhard and his bride on the occasion of their wedding. But he became, after the death of Bonhoeffer, became a very famous scholar and theologian in his own right. He came to the University of Chicago in 1961 to give some lectures on the challenge of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life and theology. And this is an absolutely historic set of lectures that Eberhard Bethge gave. I'm just going to read from that opening. During his lifetime, Bonhoeffer was never in the headlines of a newspaper, either in his own country or abroad, as were Niemöller, Barth, and Debelius. Only twice did he enjoy the excitement of being a speaker at a great meeting. In 1934, he addressed the famous ecumenical meeting in Fano, and in 1936, he spoke at a crowded meeting of confessing church members at the Olympic Games in Berlin. Bonhoeffer did not care for publicity. He did not try for the skillful handling of the means of mass communication. While many of his colleagues accepted small compromises in order to continue reaching and teaching the crowds, he did not seek to reach mass audiences. Yet there was that self-confidence in his cause, which ascribes to Luther, Lessing, Hugo, Wolff, and also to Karl Barth, the hilaritous serenity that might be described as confidence in their own work. It was certainly a boldness and defiance of the world and of popular opinion. That's the way he decides to describe Bonhoeffer. But listen to this when he says, at the age of 30, he was barred from his academic post. When he was 34, the pulpit was closed to him. At 35, written publication was forbidden. And by his imprisonment at 37, even conversation with his friends was denied him. Yet each time this narrowing circle came closer, his acting and thinking gained power and stretched into new dimensions. And when he was silenced for good at 39, he began to speak more loudly than ever before. That's the man I want to talk about tonight, this young man, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It's very interesting that after the war, Bonhoeffer became known to the English-speaking world because of people like Bethge, and because some of the things he had written were translated into English and were being read and studied in the English-speaking world. Life Together, his book he wrote in 1936, The Cost of Discipleship, probably his most famous book, which was his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. And then the Letters and Papers from Prison that he wrote. And then he started to write a book called Ethics while he was in prison. And some fragments of that were found and were published. So really, there aren't that many things published from Bonhoeffer. And only in the last few years, the letters he wrote to Maria von Wiedemeyer, his fiancée, have just finally been published. But they've only been published in just the last few years. So if you collected Bonhoeffer, and I've collected all of Bonhoeffer, it would only be on your bookshelf about that far to collect all of Bonhoeffer. The interesting thing is that Germany, after the war, showed no interest in Bonhoeffer at all. In fact, Germans weren't interested in Bonhoeffer. They weren't interested in thinking about what had happened in World War II. They had a German phrase, let the grass grow over it. And so they showed no interest. And now, an amazing thing has happened. In fact, I have a young friend has written an actual dissertation on what has happened with the memory of Dietrich Bonhoeffer in modern Germany. Today, in Germany, everybody knows about Bonhoeffer. There are many, many streets named Bonhoeffer Allee, Bonhoeffer Street. His house in Berlin is now a museum, the house where he was arrested by the Gestapo, and where his parents lived, too, the houses side by side. A number of churches have honored him, naming buildings after him. And a great museum in Berlin, I was in Berlin just 2 years ago, because I did a whole series of lectures on Bonhoeffer on a ship we were riding from Prague to Berlin, and so I gave these lectures on Bonhoeffer, and then we ended up in Berlin. And I was amazed to see all the museums, because I've been to Berlin earlier on, and how it's changed in terms of Germany now wants to remember, is trying to understand what happened in that terrifying time of the Third Reich. And they have a museum now, which was once the Luftwaffe headquarters, and in all of the bombing of Berlin during the war, that one building somehow escaped without being bombed. And so I went to that museum. It's the Museum on the Resistance, it's called. It's a great, huge museum, and it has a huge section on the Confessing Church, which I was so grateful to see, the Confessing Church movement that we talked about last week when Karl Barth and Martin Niemöller started the Pastors' Emergency League and then the Barmen Declaration in 1934, and that was the founding of the Confessing Church movement. So they had a whole section on the Confessing Church. And it's in this ironic place. It's in the Luftwaffe building. Out in front of that building is where von Stauffenberg was shot after the attempt on Hitler's life. He and several other men in that office were actually shot. So they have a monument to von Stauffenberg out in front. And then inside are, as you enter, and I think it's very worthwhile to go to that museum if you go to Berlin, you'll see huge banners as you enter. One is by a communist who had been persecuted and was a part of the resistance. And then another was a political leader who had been a part of the resistance. And then another great banner with a picture of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and then another banner with a picture of Martin Niemöller. And when I was in Berlin, I also had a chance to go to Martin Niemöller's church, where Bonhoeffer had preached a number of times. And that church is now a church that a lot of people go to see as well in Dahlem. But these huge banners that honor Niemöller, who was with Barth, the author of the Barmen Declaration, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So now Germany wants to understand who this man was. So now there's a great interest in Germany, just like there has been in the English-speaking world for a long time. As Betke said, when his life was closed down in 1945, then he spoke more loudly than ever before. But not in Germany at first, in the English-speaking world, but now in Germany as well. Everyone in Germany now knows who Dietrich Bonhoeffer is, and he's a great hero in Germany today. I want to tell you about him. I've got a couple of books that I can do a little bit of show and tell with regard to him. This is a wonderful book. I don't know if it's still in print. I hope it is. It was published by Fortress Press, and it's called Dietrich Bonhoeffer, A Life in Pictures. But it has wonderful pictures of Bonhoeffer, and afterward, if some of you want to come up and look at some of these great pictures, you can. Bonhoeffer, who is this young man? He was born as a twin. His sister, Sabine, and he were born February 4th, 1906. Okay, that's the date. They were next to the last in a group of eight children in the Bonhoeffer family. They had eight beautiful children, really. It's kind of a sad story when you think of it. This son, Walter, was killed in World War I, and he wrote a very touching letter to his family just hours before he died in a field hospital. His Bible, Bonhoeffer carried his brother Walter's Bible to the very day he died. He never had that Bible out of his possession, the Bible of his brother, his older brother. Klaus Bonhoeffer, his older brother, became president of Lufthansa Airlines and was killed in 1945 by direct order of Heinrich Himmler. All this family were wiped out, basically, by Heinrich Himmler after the attempt on Hitler's life. So Klaus was assassinated. These two daughters were married to young men who were also killed by order of the SS and the Gestapo. Here's Dietrich Bonhoeffer. His sister Sabine married a young Jewish man and got out of Germany, thank God, went to London. But one of the reasons that these were persecuted was because the the German Gestapo found out that she had married a Jewish man and had got out of Germany, and they punished the family all the more. She survived. So in a way, and these two women, they also survived. But think of it, their two husbands, this young man, all died in this family. And then Bonhoeffer also was hung in 1945 at Flossenbürg. So it's a kind of a sad story for a family. The family was a remarkable family. Karl Bonhoeffer was the father. He was not a believer. He was a skeptic all his life. He was a professor of psychiatry at the University of Berlin. Here's an irony. He was the one that was asked to give the psychological examination of the young Dutch communist who was accused of burning the Reichstag. Isn't that something? When he was accused of burning the Reichstag, he was sent over to the University of Berlin, Department of Psychiatry, to study because he was considered insane. Professor Karl Bonhoeffer was a very famous professor of psychiatry. Here's another irony. 5 days before his son was arrested in his house, Karl Bonhoeffer received the highest award any civilian gets in Germany, an award signed by Adolf Hitler himself called the Goethe Award. It'd be like the Pulitzer Prize in the United States. Was given to Karl Bonhoeffer 5 days before his son was arrested. And so it's an interesting story. He married a beautiful young woman named Paula, who was a believer, a very gentle and sensitive young Christian woman. And here's what she wrote. She's a remarkable lady. And they had these 8 children she raised. As a young woman, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's mother insisted on taking a teacher's examination. In April 1894, she was awarded the diploma for teaching in the middle schools and the high schools for girls. The family later handed down her comment, and this is a comment she wrote later. Germans had their backbones broken twice in their lives, she wrote. First in school and then in the army. And that's why she taught her children herself in her early years. She said, isn't that interesting? She said, German children had their backbones broken twice. In school and in the army. So she was a great influence in Bonhoeffer's life. The fact that she was a strong believer had a positive and wonderful influence in his life. The other influence in his life was his grandmother. And his grandmother was really quite a remarkable lady. Her name was Julie. And Julia, that would be grandmother on his father's side. Here's a great picture of Julia. She just looks like a powerful lady. Julia wrote in 1932 a verse for one of her great-grandchildren, who was Christoph von Dieny. Dieny was married to Christine, one of the girls. He was also assassinated by the SS. His son is a very famous conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra in the United States. He just retired. So he is a nephew of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, living here in the United States, and just retired as a very prominent conductor. Is it Cincinnati Symphony or the Detroit Symphony? Very famous. Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. When he was a little boy in 1932, his grandmother wrote this poem for him. When you were as small as I, upon a horse you'd ride. But when I am as old as you, they'll send men to the moon. She wrote that in 1932. So she was quite a lady. A year later, in 1933, the old lady defied the SA, which would be a part of the Hitler movement, cordon around a Berlin restaurant that was demonstrating a boycott of Jewish businesses. So she defied that boycott, marched in defiance. So she had that kind of legacy in her life. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer was very devoted to her and gave the oration and a great tribute to her at her funeral in 1936. So this young man, when he was still just a very young man, he wrote after his name, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, T-H-E-O-L, theologian. And he didn't even probably know what a theologian was, but before, his father is a skeptic, his mother's a believer, and the family's not really a church-going family, except for his mother's quiet faith. But this young boy wrote T-H-E-O-L, theologian, after his name when he was about 10 years old. Well, he fulfilled that. He did it. He went on to school and decided to study theology, and he did. He studied theology at Tübingen. Remember last week, Karl Barth went to Tübingen because his father wanted him to go to Tübingen. And then he went to Berlin. And that's where he actually got his doctorate at Berlin. He became a lecturer at Berlin. And while he was a student, in 1924, he discovered my hero from last week, Karl Barth, who becomes the great influence in Bonhoeffer's life as a young man. And I'll read a wonderful quotation here about that discovery of Barth in this book. It has a nice quotation on that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer discovered Karl Barth between his stay in Rome and the beginning of his doctoral work in the autumn of 1924. In Barth's collection of lectures, The Word of God and Theology, which appeared in 1924, Bonhoeffer read, God does not want to be, this is what Bonhoeffer wrote about what Barth had taught, God does not want to be a beyond the other side of the world. He does not want to be the basis of a history of religion, but he wants to be the Lord of our life. I like that. This young man was quite taken by Barth. In 1925, he actually meets Karl Barth personally. His comments about that are quite interesting and instructive. He says, he got to know Karl Barth personally. I was even more impressed by his discussion than by his writings and lectures. That's the complete Barth. I've never seen anything like it. Although the two of them were close allies in church politics from then on, their relationship was characterized by intimacy and distance. Because he was also away from Barth a lot, because soon Barth has to leave Germany and go to Switzerland. But he was quite taken by him. It's interesting, he studies theology and becomes a lecturer actually in theology, but finally he becomes a Christian. And he actually writes about that. In 1936, he wrote this to a friend. He says, then something else happened, something which has changed and transformed my life to the present day. I discovered the Bible for the first time. Not bad to discover the Bible. And remember that I told you that's exactly what happened to Karl Barth when he sat down with his friend Eduard Thurinson and said, they were disillusioned, what shall we study? Shall we study Immanuel Kant? Shall we study Karl Marx? And then Thurinson said, well, I'm going to study the Gospel of John. And Barth, in that little meeting with his friend, said, well, I'm going to study Romans. And he just took the book of Romans and started to write a commentary, to work on it verse by verse by verse. And it changed his life. That same sort of thing happened to other great people as well. It happened to Martin Luther. It happened to St. Augustine. And it happened to Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I discovered the Bible for the first time. It is also very bad to have to say that. I had preached often, and I'd seen a good deal of the church. I even spoke and wrote about it, and yet I had not become a Christian. In a wild and uncontrolled way, I was still my own master. I know that at that time I used the cause of Jesus Christ for my own advantage, for my crazy vanity. He's talking about his time in the 20s when he was doing all this doctoral work and everything. And by the way, he was a very handsome young man. A little later, he became a little bit dowdy. But if you look at, he looks like Robert Redford. I mean, very handsome young man was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And then he lost all his hair and got a little bit overweight, I guess. But look at the young Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I mean, he was a very handsome young man. So he was very full of himself, and he says that I was in sort of a wild way in his life, and then he discovered the Bible. Now I'm finished reading that. So I know that at that time I used the cause of Jesus Christ for my own advantage, for my crazy vanity. I pray to God that that will never happen again. Moreover, I had never or hardly ever prayed. But despite all this loneliness, isn't it interesting? He describes that as loneliness, even though he was very highly social, was, you know, like Barth took up beer and smoking, and probably Bonhoeffer did too. And had very social, because you had a lot of pictures of him with all his friends. But he said, despite all this loneliness, I was still quite pleased with myself. The Bible, and especially the Sermon on the Mount, freed me from this. So if it was Romans for Karl Barth, it was the Sermon on the Mount for Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And as a matter of fact, his first big book was The Cost of Discipleship, which is a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. That was his first book. The Bible, and especially the Sermon on the Mount, freed me from this. Since then, everything has changed. I have felt that plainly, I have felt that plainly. And so have other people around me. You know, that's not bad. Someone like Helmut Thielicke says, no one ever says in the New Testament, I have the gifts of the Holy Spirit. It's always said about them. It's nice, isn't it? So if somebody comes up to you and says, do you have the gifts of the Holy Spirit? You should say, don't ask me, ask my family. Ask the people that know me. They'll tell you if I have the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And so you shouldn't do too much naval investigation to see how much of the Holy Spirit you have. If you know Jesus Christ, and then the gifts, well, let people tell you what your gifts are. And they will, you know. They'll let you know. If you have the gift of teaching, then some people around you have the gift of learning around you, right? And some people have the gift of encouragement if you feel encouraged around them. So Bonhoeffer, he said that people have even noticed that. They've noticed it. It was a great liberation. It became clear to me that the life of a servant of Jesus Christ must belong to the Christian church. It must become even more clear, step by step, how that must now come about. And he wrote that to a friend in 1936, and when he had started this young pastor school. I'll tell you about that in just a minute. So he becomes a convinced Christian, and not just a theologian. Then, in the early 30s, he goes to London. First, he's done a lot of traveling. He was down in Barcelona, Spain, working in a German-speaking church there. And then he went to London and was a pastor at the German-speaking church in London. I always feel a tenderness toward Bonhoeffer in this regard because I spent 6 years of my life in an English-speaking church in Manila, Philippines. And when I came to Seattle Presbytery to become the senior pastor at First Press Berkeley, some people in the presbytery didn't think that I should be the pastor because I was young, and maybe too young. I remember at the meeting, some guy said to me, you've been out of the country, you've been over in Manila, how can you be relevant to us here in Berkeley now? Because Berkeley was in an explosive time now with all kinds of warfare in Berkeley. And I said, well, my hero is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he spent most of his time as the pastor of the German-speaking church in Barcelona and the German-speaking church in London, and then he went to Germany, and he was fairly relevant. So that was a little self-serving on my side to quote Bonhoeffer, but believe me, they stopped saying that anymore. It's like people say about people who've been a missionary. You've been a missionary over in Central Africa or something like that. How can you be relevant here? Hey, probably more relevant because you have an analogy from which you can look and understand. I talked to a person today who told me that he's now studying the Bible in a pony edition of Spanish and English. He wanted to study his Spanish and get better in his Spanish. So he decided, what better way to do it than to get a pony edition where one page is Spanish and the page opposite is English. And he's going through the Bible now, reading it, and he said, the interesting thing is, he has got more out of the English text now than he ever did before because he's reading it with the Spanish and English. Isn't that funny? So having been to another country, like Bonhoeffer became very fluent in English, which helped, you'll see in a minute, in his life and his writing. But also, he was in England during the time of the Barman Declaration. And I have to read you a funny letter that Karl Barth wrote to him in light of that. He's now over in England, and Karl Barth writes this kind of humorous but important little letter. It's not in that book. It's in this book. It's in the Karl Barth book. So I got to get the right book. He wrote this. He was frustrated that Bonhoeffer was in England because he knew Bonhoeffer well and knew what a fine young theologian he was. And to his regret, so he says, Bonhoeffer should either stop playing Elijah under the juniper tree or Jonah under the gourd. That he should come back on the next ship. And so Bonhoeffer did. He came back on the next ship because Barth said, don't be Elijah under the juniper or Jonah under the gourd. Come back. We need you here. And so he came back. He came back, he had his post technically at University of Berlin, but when he signed the Confessing Church movement and became a part of the Confessing Church, signed the Barman Declaration and became a part of that, then he lost his post. That's what Eberhard Becky is saying. He lost his post at the University of Berlin. And he lost his right to preach in the official German church. So then what does he do? He goes to Finkenwald, a little town in Germany, south of Berlin, and he forms what you might be called a clandestine, a seminary for confessing church pastors. Now, the good thing about this period in his life, because since he doesn't have a big church job, since he didn't comply with the Arian paragraph and didn't comply with the things that the state church required of Protestant pastors then, he is now a confessing church pastor, which means he doesn't have a regular post. He's still a pastor ordained by the German Evangelical Church, but he doesn't have a post. So he goes and Finkenwald starts his seminary for pastors who are in the confessing church movement. Because of that, he writes. So we're grateful for that. He writes The Cost of Discipleship, first of all. That very important book, 1936. Then he writes a book about Finkenwald itself called Life Together. How many of you have read Life Together? That is a great book on the Christian church. And one of the great books on the Christian church is Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And so in a way, the fact that he was deprived of the chance... You remember, I made a joke about this with regard to Paul. Paul's disadvantages become our advantage. The fact that Paul was in prison so much enabled him to write his prison epistles. The traveling Paul who's going to church, to church, to church, won't have time to write to the Galatians, won't have time to write to the Ephesians, won't have time to write to the Philippians. But because he was in a Roman prison, he does have time. And so that imprisonment ended up to our benefit. Bonhoeffer's lack of being able to be posted, the fact that he got fired from this lucrative university job where he could just sit around all the time and smoke cigars and give a couple of lectures. I mean, let's face it, professors in the German university system have got it made, especially if they get a post. It's really made. And you aren't so productive because you assign all the hard, productive work to your young associates. So he doesn't have that job. So he goes to Finkenwald on a shoestring, and he writes his book, Cost of Discipleship. He writes Life Together there. And something else happens there. Parents and grandparents are not happy with the German Christian pastors who have now complied with the Arian paragraph and have complied with all the things that the German Third Reich has required them to do. And so some of these grandparents don't want their children, I say grandparents because I have two grandparent stories to tell you. They don't want their grandchildren to be confirmed in the German state church, but they want them confirmed by a confessing church pastor, a church pastor that really believes the gospel more. Well, one of those is a young girl named Maria von Wiedemeyer, whose grandmother arranges for young Maria von Wiedemeyer to come over to Finkenwald so that Bonhoeffer, young Bonhoeffer, I don't know if this grandmother had ulterior motives or not, but she wanted her granddaughter to study for her confirmation with a young man who was pastor at Finkenwald, and that's how Bonhoeffer met his sweetheart, Maria von Wiedemeyer. He wrote all these beautiful letters to Maria von Wiedemeyer when he was in prison, and as I said, they've only been published just 4 years ago. Because she had never published any of those wonderful letters, these love letters, from Bonhoeffer to Maria von Wiedemeyer, for personal reasons. But at any rate, that's how he met her. I told this very story because I gave a lecture on Bonhoeffer in Seattle. An amazing thing happened. I had a man in my church. He's now gone to be with the Lord. His name was Alfred Bauer. Alfred Bauer became a very famous doctor in America, because he created a technique that was used in pediatrics and still used to this day. It's called the Bauer technique. And he became a very wealthy pediatrician, a great man. He was in our church in Seattle, German. He had been in the German army in World War II. He had an amazing story to tell. He wrote his entire history and he showed it to me before he died. And he was captured by the Allies in World War II in the Battle of the Bulge and was in a British prison camp as a captured German soldier, and he was walking in the parade ground, and he ran into his brother, and they had been separated for 2.5 years while they were both in the army in different places, and so they had a reunion in that prison camp. That was very touching. But anyway, after the war was over, he finished his medicine, he came to the United States, and he became a very famous doctor in the United States and in Seattle, and a member of our church, and he became one of my great friends. I told this story about Maria von Wiedemeyer, and Alfred Bauer made a beeline for me afterward and came up to me and said, "Earl, thank you for telling me that story. You put a piece of the puzzle of my life together. When I was a boy, I was in the Hitler Youth, because that's, you had to be in the Hitler Youth to go on in school and everything else. And then I ended up in the Army, of course, and he fought in the Army in World War II. My grandmother wanted me to be confirmed by a pastor different than the pastor in the church where we were. And she sent me over, and it was a big job for me to go over to be confirmed by this different pastor, and I never knew why. It was because his grandmother wanted him confirmed by a believing, confessing church pastor. Isn't that some story? And so Alfred Bauer came up and told me that. And he put that in his life story when he later wrote his life story. That same thing that von Wiedemeyer, that's how she meets Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Well, finally, the Finkenwald School is closed by the Gestapo too. They close it, and then in 1938... So now Bonhoeffer's lost his post as the university. He's lost his chance to have this. They scatter. They said, you cannot meet here anymore. You cannot do this. And so then he went to America. His family is quite wealthy, as you might imagine. And so he decided to go to America, to Union Seminary. He'd already been there once. I told you he traveled a lot. He came in 1931 and went to Union Seminary in New York. And then in 1939, he came again to Union Seminary, but only stayed a short time. He became very frustrated when he came to America in 1939 and decided and took the last ship to leave the United States to go back to Germany. All of his pacifist friends and his liberal friends in America were very upset with him. One of them was my professor, Paul Lehmann, who I knew at Princeton, who was a number of letters were written by Dietrich Bonhoeffer to Paul Lehmann. They met at Union Seminary at that time. They were both the same age. Reinhold Niebuhr became a great friend of Bonhoeffer's on that time when he was there at Union. But in July 27, 1939, he went back on the last ship to return to Germany. And all of his friends in America said, what are you doing? Germany is at war. They've already declared they're attacking Poland and everything looks terrible. Why are you doing it? And he wrote this. This is a famous line he wrote to Reinhold Niebuhr. He said, if I do not live with my people during their hour of trial, I shall have no right to be with them in their hour of rebuilding. And he went back and scandalized all his American pacifist friends by joining the OKW. He joined the Army. He joined the counterintelligence division of the German Army under Admiral Canaris. And that division, as you know, finally, people out of that division didn't hatch the plot against Hitler in 1945, for which they were all executed. Even Bonhoeffer, who was in prison at the time, had no relationship to it at all. Yet he was also executed for that reason. The entire family was wiped out because of their connection to the OKW, to Admiral Canaris. He joined that. Nobody understood. All his American friends thought Bonhoeffer's gone bad. Even Bart suspected him. He heard. In fact, one of the most touching and sad letters, I think, of the Bonhoeffer letters is a letter he wrote to Karl Barth in 1991 because he made a trip to Switzerland in 1942. In 1942, he made a trip to Switzerland for the OKW on a German passport. What he was doing, which no one knew, we know now, he was making contact with a Bishop Bell from England. He also made a trip to Sweden to make contact with this Bishop Bell from England, who was an emissary from Winston Churchill. And they met, and what Bonhoeffer did, representing Admiral Canaris, was, since he spoke such good English, was that they were trying to convince Bell to convince Churchill to not demand unconditional surrender. Then they felt they could get the army to have an uprising against Hitler if they didn't have unconditional surrender to look at. And Churchill and Roosevelt both disagreed. As you know, after the Atlantic Charter and the Atlantic meeting of Churchill and Roosevelt, the decision was made that Germany would have to unconditionally surrender. Because actually Rommel was, in an informal way, was related to that group. And General Beck and others probably would have tried, that was the dream of Canaris, they would be able to get them to uprise. So Bonhoeffer made these trips to meet these British representatives secretly to try to convince them to get that change. And well, when he made his trip to Switzerland, the rumors were spreading. Here he is doing spy work because he was in the counter-espionage division of the German army. And so he heard that Barth was disappointed in him. So this is a letter he wrote to Karl Barth. "Please excuse me, Herr Professor, if I now write, what I now write is nonsense and not worth saying, but I have to ask you because the matter concerns me very much. When I heard last week in Zurich for the first time that you mistrusted my stay here because of my mission, I just laughed. Now I've heard the same thing a second time here in Geneva. And having thought about it for a couple of days, I just want to tell you that at a time in which so much must be based simply on personal trust, everything is finished when mistrust emerges." And to that, Karl Barth wrote a wonderful, very short letter back because he didn't want to hurt Bonhoeffer and compromise him. He just wrote back to him, "We're glad that you came." That's all he wrote back, which again was smart on Barth's part. So that in no way would that, but so Barth decided to trust him. What these people were going through is just hard for us to understand, but I just wanted you to get a feel for that. In 1939, he comes back. He gets into the OKW. Then, without any warning, and with the only thing we can think of, is that the word had got that his sister Sabine had married a Jewish man and had gone to London. Some people think that was one of the ostensible reasons why the Gestapo decided to arrest Sabine's twin brother. But they came to his house April 5th, 1943, and they arrested him with no charges. No charges were ever filed against him. His dad and his mother made every kind of appeal possible to find out what the charges were, what he was being held for. He was always being held for interrogation and suspicion, but no charges. And so April 5th, 43, he was taken. He was put in Tegel prison. And in fact, if you go to Tegel prison, you can see it. That's where the old airport in Berlin. They have his cell. Then he was taken to Buchenwald, and then he was finally taken to Flossenbürg. He wrote letters while he was in prison. I'm going to read some of those to you right now. He also worked on a book when he was in prison. He wrote some beautiful poems when he was in prison. The interesting thing is that the guards in every one of those prisons were really kind to him, by and large. In fact, there's a couple of photographs in this book. You can see them for yourself. Of Bonhoeffer standing with some other prisoners, with a German officer standing with them in this photograph. And it seems mysterious. Why is this picture of these prisoners lined up with the German officer there? And later we found out that the German officer had befriended Bonhoeffer, and he wanted a picture of Bonhoeffer for his family to see. And he had to do it in a subversive way. He couldn't have a picture of just himself with Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer, in effect, had become a pastor to him. But he wanted his family to see this great man. So he lines them up with a group of just ordinary prisoners. And the picture is taken. There's several pictures like that of officers being photographed with Bonhoeffer and other prisoners because they wanted a picture of this man. Many of these officers actually smuggled his writings out. And we're grateful for that. Because they were very strict censorship and all that. And yet his letters were being smuggled. And his ethics manuscript was being smuggled out by these guards that were doing that at their own personal risk. So that is a part of the strange picture of all of this time. When he was put in the prison and that writing period of his life began, he wrote some of his most powerful stuff. And that's why I'm going to let him speak for himself now. This book you all should own. It's the Letters and Papers from Prison. Now, the new, greatly enlarged edition. Get the latest edition if you can. The Letters and Papers from Prison. It starts out with a Christmas letter that he sent to his friends, which is absolutely a classic document. And it's called After 10 Years. It's a reckoning made at New Year's in 1943. So as a Christmas gift to his friends, he sent this wonderful After 10 Years piece. And it really is it's profound. Listen to some of this at the beginning. "The great masquerade of evil has played havoc with all our ethical concepts. For evil to appear disguised as light, charity, historical necessity, that's like communism, or social justice, again, communism or national socialism, is quite bewildering to anyone brought up on our traditional ethical concepts. While for the Christian, who bases his life on the Bible, it merely confirms the fundamental wickedness of evil. And then he goes through the kinds of people that can't make it in that kind of world. Reasonable people, the reasonable people's failure is obvious. With the best of intention and a naive lack of realism, they think that with a little reason, they can bend back into position the framework that has got out of joint. And in their lack of vision, they want to do justice to all sides, all conflicting forces, but they wear them down and nothing then ends up achieved. They step aside, finally, in resignation or collapse before the stronger party. Whoever is stronger finally wins out. Still more pathetic is a total collapse of moral fanaticism. It's interesting what he says about moral fanatics. The fanatic thinks, and this is a tremendous insight into fanaticism, whether it's Christian fanaticism or Islamic fanaticism or any kind of fanaticism. Listen to this. The moral fanatic thinks that his single-minded principles qualify him to do battle with the power of evil. But like a bull that rushes to the red cloak instead of the person who's holding it, he exhausts himself and is beaten. He gets entangled in non-essentials and falls into the trap set by cleverer people. And then there's the man of conscience who fights single-handedly against heavy odds in situations that call for a decision. But the scale of the conflict in which he has to choose, with no advice or support except from his own conscience. That's the person that says, I just have my own gyroscope here. I don't need anybody else's advice or anything else like the Bible. I don't need any, just me. I'll do it all for myself. He says it tears that person to pieces. It's interesting. For a man whose only support is his conscience, he can never realize that a bad conscience may be stronger and more wholesome than a deluded one. At least if it's bad, you can call it bad and then later repent for that. Then he talks about the people who are just driven by duty and just simply obeying orders. And then he says, who stands fast? Only the man whose final standard is not his own reason, his own principles, his conscience, his freedom, his virtue, but is ready to sacrifice all this when he's called to obedient and responsible action in faith and exclusive allegiance to God. And the responsible man tries to make a whole life, in his whole life, an answer to the question and the call of God. It's right, almost right, out of his Cost of Discipleship, Sermon on the Mount. And who are these responsible people? And then in this essay, he tries to talk about people that can play that kind of role. One of the most beautiful of the short pieces in the After 10 Years essays is a few articles of faith on the sovereignty of God in history. I believe that God can and will be good, will bring good out of evil, even out of the greatest evil. And for that purpose, he needs men and women who make the best use of everything. I believe that God will give us all the strength we need to help us to resist in time of distress, but he never gives it in advance, lest we should rely on ourselves and not on him alone. A faith such as this should allay all our fears for the future. I believe that even our mistakes and shortcomings are turned to good account. And that it's, and here's a great line, it's no harder for God to deal with them than with our supposedly good deeds. Have you ever thought of the fact that God has to cope with your good deeds? I just meant to be a help, you know. How many times storming into the kitchen, you know, to remember that here's a kid with his dad out and they're trying, the car has a flat tire. And the boy is trying to get the tire to work, and the father comes up and says, here, Butterfingers, let me do it. I'm just helping you. Well, maybe not, you know. Maybe you're just diminishing him all the more. So he says, God has to cope with our good deeds, too. And then his last line is so marvelous. I believe that God is no timeless fate, but that he waits for and answers sincere prayers and responsible actions. That is just one of the great sections. And probably the most famous of these would be his great section on the past and the present and the future, and then his great section on optimism. He says, most people have had to abandon planning for the future, and they're forced back into just living just for the moment, irresponsibly, frivolously, or resignedly. And some few dream longingly of a better time to come, and they try to forget the present. And Bonhoeffer says, we find both of these courses equally impossible. And there remains for us only the very narrow way, often extremely difficult to find, and here's a very famous line from Bonhoeffer, of living every day as if it were our last, and yet living in faith and responsibility as though there were to be a great future. Boy, I've quoted that a lot to young people and to older people. You have to live every day as if it were your last, and every day as if there were a great future. We live always that way. Because after all, 100% of us die. And nothing can change the percentage. But we are alive now, and we can take advantage of what we've got right now to live for the future and for the great hope. And then he quotes Jeremiah. Houses and fields and vineyards shall again be bought in this land, proclaims Jeremiah. Remember, that's the land that the Babylonians are camped on. And that's the mark of the covenant. Tell the people that they're going to have deeds and they're going to build houses on that land. But that's where the Babylonians are. And that's a great promise from Jeremiah. Okay. It's wiser to be pessimistic. It's a way of avoiding disappointment and ridicule. And so wise people condemn optimism. Now, the essence of optimism is not its view of the present, but the fact that it is inspiration of life and hope when others give in. It enables a man or woman to hold his head high when everything seems to be going wrong. It gives him strength to sustain reverses and yet to claim the future for himself instead of abandoning it to his opponent. Now, it's true, there is a silly, cowardly kind of optimism which must be condemned. But the optimism that is the will for the future should never be despised, even if it's proved wrong 100 times. It is health and vitality, and the sick man has no business to impugn it. Very famous section on Bonhoeffer's outlook toward life. You can read this for yourself, but that's the After 10 Years pieces. They're really just absolutely marvelous. It's interesting, he wrote so many reflections to his friend Eberhard Bethke, and they're throughout this letter. Here's one that I think is interesting when he's writing about his studies in Berlin under Professor Harnack. Remember how Bart had also studied under Harnack? He says, I remember in my student days a discussion between Professor Hall, the sociologist, and Professor Harnack, the theologian, as to whether in great historical, intellectual, and spiritual moments or movements, they made headway through their primary or their secondary motives. At the time, I thought Hall was right in maintaining the former. In other words, what's the most important thing about a movement? Its primary goals or its secondary goals? He says, Hall said, it's the primary goals that are the most important, okay? And evidently, Harnack was saying, no, it's the secondary goals that are important. So at the time, I thought that Professor Hall was right in maintaining the former. And now I know he was wrong. You think about that your secondary motives, how you treat people, in other words, the means you use will outlast your goals, your ends. Because everybody has glorious ends. I mean, everybody wants to save humanity. Everybody loves everybody in general. But it's how you treat people in particular that lasts longer than what your great goals are. And so he said the secondary motives, the methods you're using to advance your goal have longer staying power than the goal. And Bonhoeffer saw that. And this book is just filled with those kinds of insights that he has with Bethke. He has another one that's quite interesting where he says, I'm now reading the Old Testament a lot. I'll read what it says here. My thoughts and feelings now seem to be getting more and more like the Old Testament. And in recent months, I've been reading the Old Testament even more than the New Testament. And then comes this line. It is only when one knows the unutterability of the name of God that one can utter the name of Jesus Christ. In other words, you need to know how vast God is, like you get in the Yahweh in the Old Testament. Remember, take your shoes off. You're standing on holy ground. Then you can say the name Jesus Christ, because now you see how great he is. It is only when one loves life and the earth so much that without them, everything seems to be over. Remember, the Jews loved the earth, and they loved the physical property, yourself, your body, that one thing that's great about the Jewish understanding of your personality is that you're seen as a whole person, body and spirit. No Gnosticism there at all. You're not turned into a phantom. You're a real person. So he says, it's only when you love that so much that without them everything seems to be over, that one may then believe in the resurrection. Because remember, the resurrection is that your concrete self is beloved. It's wonderful. It is only when one submits to God's law that one may speak of grace. I mean, cheap grace is grace taught as a general truth. But the grace that comes after you've struggled with the law and trying to be faithful, like Paul does in Romans 6, 7, and 8. So he's giving a commentary on that. It's only when God's wrath and vengeance are hanging as grim realities over the heads of one's enemies that something of what it means to love and forgive them can touch our hearts. When you see that God's judgment is over us, and then I can discover what forgiveness is. That now he's taken us straight to the cross. Now here's an interesting line. In my opinion, it's not Christian to want to take our thoughts and feelings too quickly from the New Testament. He said, we've already talked about this several times, and every day it confirms my opinion. And here comes the famous line from Bonhoeffer. One must not and cannot speak the last word until you've said the next to the last word. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You have to say the next to the last word before you can say the last word. That's why everybody say, oh, I just believe in love. Love is everything. Oh, but you've got to first see the call to righteousness. Then you can talk about love. But you've got to have the next to the last word. The law. Like Luther always talks about the law and the gospel. It's never, you know, we have a lot of people say, oh, I just want gospel. I just want love for everybody. But what about the truth? See? And Bonhoeffer is making a big point of that. Well, you can read this for yourself. I'm not going to... I've got to stop right now. But I do want to read you his great poem. He wrote an absolutely amazing poem in his imprisonment that many, many people have been deeply, deeply touched by. My daughter, when she was a student at University of Washington, did a senior recital because she was a theater arts major. In this, she did this whole recital and committed to memory this poem and ended her recital with this poem. It was such a moving experience to see your daughter do this poem in front of her students there at University of Washington. It's the great Bonhoeffer poem, Who Am I? Who am I? They often tell me I would step from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from his country house. Who am I? They often tell me I would talk to my warders freely, friendly, and clearly, as though it were mine to command. Who am I? They also tell me I would bear the days of misfortune equably, smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. Am I then really all that other men tell of, or am I only what I know of myself, restless and longing and sick like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colors, for flowers, for the voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, for neighborliness, trembling with anger at despotisms and petty humiliation, tossing in expectation of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint and ready to say farewell to it all. Who am I? This or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once, a hypocrite before others, and before myself a contemptibly woebegone weakling? Or is something within me still like a beaten army, fleeing in disorder from victory already achieved? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. It's a great poem. It's probably his greatest poem.